This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Patti Smith at the Minetta Lane, Words and Music. Written by Patti Smith. Performed by Patti Smith, Jesse Paris Smith, Jackson Smith, and Tony Shanahan. Patti Smith appears courtesy of Columbia Records.
My daughter, Jesse Paris Smith. So, welcome to Hyper Living Theater. And I was trying to think out what exactly is Hyper Living Theater? It's sort of like no nudity, but the naked mind. And even more dangerous, the collective naked mind. So we'll see what we can do tonight. And also wanted to wish you happy fall. And so Jesse and I would like to perform a little poem by Rainer Marie Rilke, and it is his autumn poem. It is time. The summer was immense. Lay your shadow on the sundials and let loose the wind in the fields. Bid the last fruits to be full. Give them another two more southerly days. Press them to ripeness and chase the last sweetness into the heavy wine. Whoever has no house now will not build one anymore. Whoever is alone now will remain so for a long time. Will stay up, read, write long letters, and wander the avenues up and down, restlessly while the leaves are blowing. Lord, it is time. The summer was immense. Lay your shadow on the sundials and let loose the wind in the fields. So I'd like to introduce Tony Shanahan. My son, Jackson Smith. So, oh, you know what? I just had this autumn memory. So while they're tuning up, I'll tell you, when I was in grade school, we had to make leaf ashtrays for our parents. And it was their autumn present. I guess we were supposed to give them to them on Thanksgiving. And so we had to go out into the yard, into the schoolyard, and collect a big maple leaf or some big leaf. And we all got our leaf, and then we pressed it in the clay, and we cut it out and curved it like an ashtray. You have to remember, this is 50s. Everybody chain smoked. And then they had, you know, many, many colors to make it bright, happy, beautiful autumn leaf colors. And everybody sort of, they all sort of look similar. And I decided to take a different route. So I made mine sort of brownish, and everybody else's were brightly colored. And when they came out of the kiln, my teacher was a bit perturbed. And she said, "Patty Lee, why do you have this dull brown-looking leaf?" And I said, "Well, because my leaf is a dying leaf." And she looked at me and she said, "Patty Lee, you can't put ash in a dying leaf." And I remember thinking, even at 7, and even though she was a lot taller than me, there was something intrinsically wrong with her logic. In any event, just a little autumn tale. We're going to go to summer, the summer of 1967. I left home. I was 20. I left rural South Jersey with a few dollars on the Greyhound bus, and I came to New York City looking for a job. It was Friday, July 21st, and unexpectedly I collided with the sorrow of an age. John Coltrane, the man who gave us a love supreme, had died. Scores of people were gathering around St. Peter's Church to say goodbye. Hours passed. People were sobbing as the love cry of Albert Eiler spirited the atmosphere. It was as if a saint had died, one who had offered up healing music, yet was not permitted to heal himself. Along with many strangers, I experienced a deep sense of loss for a man I had not known save through his music. Later, I walked down 7th Avenue, and then down 2nd Avenue, which is what I really walked down. I was going to just leave it, but 7th Avenue and 2nd Avenue in 1967 were very, very different. Later, I walked down 2nd Avenue, Frank O'Hara territory. Pink light washed over rows of boarded up buildings. New York light, the light of the abstract expressionists. I thought Frank would have loved the color of the fading day. And had he lived, he might have written an elegy for John Coltrane like he did for Billie Holiday. I spent the evening checking out the action on St. Mark's Place. Long-haired boys scatting around in striped bell-bottoms and used military jackets, flanked with girls wrapped in tie-dye. There were flyers paper in the street announcing the coming of Paul Butterfield and Country Joe and the Fish. White Rabbit was blaring from the open doors of the Electric Circus. The air was heavy with unstable chemicals, mold, and the earthy stench of hashish. I was from South Jersey. Truthfully, I had never even seen hashish. I only read about it in, like, you know, Moroccan tales of the desert and desert cafes. But it was in the air. I remember sitting on the stoop in St. Mark's, and it was like 6 o'clock, and then it was 9 o'clock, and I had no idea where the time went. I can't say that I fit in, but I felt safe. No one noticed me. I could move freely. There was a roving community of young people sleeping in the parks, in makeshift tents, the new immigrants invading the East Village. I wasn't kin to these people, but because of the free-floating atmosphere, I could roam within it. I had faith. I sensed no danger in New York City, and I never encountered any. I wasn't of interest to anyone, And that worked in my favor for the first few weeks of July when I just bummed around, free to explore by day, sleeping where I could at night. I sought doorwells, subway cars, even a graveyard, startled to awake beneath the city sky or being shaken by a strange hand. Time to move along, time to move along. It wasn't always so much fun, but I had my mantra, I'm free, I'm free. Although after several days, my other mantra, I'm hungry, I'm hungry, seemed to be in the forefront. I wasn't worried though, I just needed a break, and I wasn't going to give up. I dragged my plaid suitcase from stoop to stoop, trying not to wear out my unwelcome. It was the summer Coltrane died, the summer of Crystal Ship. Flower children raised their empty arms, and China exploded the H-bomb. Jimi Hendrix set his guitar in flames in Monterey. AM radio played Ode to Billy Joe. There were riots in Newark, Milwaukee, and Detroit. It was the summer of Elvira Madigan, the summer of love. And in the shifting atmosphere, a chance encounter changed the course of my life. It was the summer I met Robert Mapplethorpe.
In heaven blue.
just one thing could do for you. You'd be a wing in heaven blue. So Robert and I met in 1967, and we lived in Brooklyn near Pratt. And in 1969, in the summer of 1969, we came and took up residence at the Chelsea Hotel. And Robert and I had the smallest room in the hotel. Actually, it was so small it doesn't exist anymore. I think it's actually a big bathroom or clothes closet for another room. But it cost $55 a week, and I made $65 a week at Scribner's Bookstore, and Robert had odd jobs. He moved pianos, he hustled, he sometimes sold a drawing, and we made necklaces. Sometimes he'd sell a necklace, and but there were some lean days, weeks, months, but it was a pretty wondrous time. In the lobby of the Chelsea Hotel, I have to say, I mean, that was sort of my office because our room was so little. So I would get my notebook and sit on there, a couch there, and I just watched the action, you know, especially if I wasn't working or at night, I'd watch the night action. And you would see people. It was unbelievable. You'd see like Arthur C. Clarke running to the elevator, and you might see Shirley Clarke and Dion Arbus, who was always in a bad mood, and the Allman Brothers, I mean, any old people. It was like, and there was some beautiful teachers there who all took me under their wing, William Burroughs and Gregory Corso and this fella. Horn and Hardart, the queen of the automats, was just past the fish and tackle shop near the Chelsea Hotel. The routine was to get a seat in a tray, then go to the back wall where there were rows of little windows. You would slip some coins into a slot, open the glass hatch, and extract a sandwich or some fresh apple pie. It was a real Tex Avery eatery. My favorite was chicken pot pie or cheese and mustard with lettuce on a poppy seed roll. And Robert liked their two specialties, baked macaroni and cheese and chocolate milk. I was always hungry. I metabolized my food quickly. Robert could go without eating much longer than me. If we were out of money, we just didn't eat. I mean, back then, the way you ate was you got a job, and then you got paid for it, and then you bought food. That was like a 20th century concept of how you got along. So Robert might be able to function, even if he got a little shaky, but I would feel like I was going to pass out. One drizzly afternoon, I had a hankering for one of those cheese and lettuce sandwiches. I went through all our belongings and found exactly 55 cents. I slipped on my gray trench coat and my Mayakovsky cap, and headed to the automat. I got my tray and slipped my coins in, but the window wouldn't open. I tried again without luck, and then I noticed the price had gone up to 65 cents. Come on, we're recording. You're supposed to sound really... That was really good. I was disappointed, to say the least, when I heard a voice say, "Can I help?" I turned around, and it was Allen Ginsberg. We had never met, but there was no mistake in the face of one of our great poets and activists. I looked into those intense dark eyes, punctuated by his dark curly beard, and I just nodded. Allen added the extra dime and also stood me for a cup of coffee. I wordlessly followed him to his table, and then I plowed into the sandwich. Allen was talking away, and he introduced himself, and then he was talking about Walt Whitman, and I mentioned that I was raised near Camden, where Whitman was buried. When he leaned forward and looked at me intently, "Are you a girl?" he said. "Yeah," I answered. Is that a problem?" He just laughed. "I'm sorry. I took you for a very pretty boy." I got the picture immediately. Well, does this mean I got to return the sandwich? "Oh, no, enjoy it. It was my mistake." He told me he was writing a long elegy for Jack Kerouac, who had recently passed away. 3 days after Rimbaud's birthday, I said solemnly. I shook his hand, and we parted company. Sometime later, Allen became my good friend and teacher. We often reminisced about our first encounter, and he once asked how I would describe how we met. I would say, "You fed me when I was hungry," and he did. It snowed on Christmas night. Robert and I walked to Times Square to see the white billboard proclaiming, "War is over, if you want it. Happy Christmas from John and Yoko." It hung above the bookstall where Robert bought most of his men's magazines, between Child's and Benedict's, two all-night diners. Looking up, we were struck by the ingenuous humanity of this New York City tableau. Robert took my hand, and as the snow swirled around, I glanced at his face. He narrowed his eyes and nodded in affirmation, impressed to see artists take on 42nd Street. For me, it was the message. For Robert, the medium. Newly inspired, we walked to 23rd Street, to look at our new space. The necklaces we had made were hung on hooks, and he had tacked up some of our drawings. We stood at the window and looked out at the snow falling beyond the fluorescent oasis sign with its squiggly palm tree. "Look," he said, "it's snowing in the desert." I thought about a scene in Howard Hawks' movie Scarface, where Paul Muni and his girl are looking out the window at a neon sign that said, "The world is yours." Robert squeezed my hand. The 60s were coming to an end. Robert and I celebrated our birthdays. Robert turned 23. Then I turned 23, the perfect prime number. Robert made me a tie rack with the image of the Virgin Mary. I gave him 7 silver skulls on a length of leather. He wore the skulls. I wore a tie. We felt ready for the 70s. "It's our decade," he said. Aww. So this next song, we were in our practice room, and there's so many dark things happening in the world, and I was looking out the window, and I put my hand on the window pane, and I truthfully felt so despairing. And my late brother Todd had such a beautiful heart, and I put my hand on the window pane, and I felt him. You can't think of him. You couldn't think of my brother Todd without smiling. He just had that effect. So it was a glimmer of hope in a moment of sorrow. And then I walked back and sat down, and Tony and I wrote this song.
Yesterday I saw you standing there with your hands against the pane, looking out the window at the rain, and I wanted to tell you all your tears were not in vain.
Aspect bright and fair. sleeping. It was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the Falmouth, shining valleys, where the pure air, where fight, and my senses, newly opened, 'cause I awakened to the cry that the people have the power to redeem the work of fools upon the meek. The grace is shower. Thank you. People of the Power was written by Fred Sonic Smith and I in 1986. I was a few months pregnant with Jesse, and I was sort of in a grumpy mood, and I was in the kitchen, and I was peeling potatoes. And Fred came in, and he said, "Tricia." I said, "Yeah." And he said, "People have the power. Write it." So I'm looking at this potato and actually thinking how the potato is like sort of a metaphor for, you know, the whole of the world. You have Mr. Potato Head, and you have the Potato Eaters by Van Gogh, and then you have like those potato chips that have like images of the Virgin Mary in them. And I looked at him and I said, "Aye, aye, Captain." And we wrote People of the Power. And we talked about it quite a bit, what we wanted to say and impart in this song. It was Fred's great dream that someday this song would be embraced as an anthem anywhere in the world, anywhere where people needed it, where they needed words or music to incite or encourage them, or as a banner to their marches. And he didn't live to see that, but we did. And I have been in marches in many parts of the world and hearing people sing. And each time this happens, I know that he would have been so happy. I left New York City in 1979, and Fred and I got married in 1980, and we had two wonderful children. And but I thought I'd read you a little about early life in Michigan. Fred and I had no specific time frame. In 1979, we lived at the Book Cadillac Hotel in downtown Detroit. We live round the clock, moving through the days and nights with little regard for time. We would stay up until dawn talking, then sleep until nightfall. When we awoke, we'd search for 24-hour diners or stop and mill around at Art Van's furniture outlet that opened at midnight and served free coffee and powdered donuts. Sometimes we'd just drive aimlessly and stop before the sun rose at some motel in a place like Port Huron or Saginaw, and we'd sleep all day. Fred loved the arcade bar. It was real close to our hotel. It opened in the mornings, a 30s-style bar with a few booths, a grill, and a large railway clock with no hands. You know those clocks, you know what I mean? They're real giant and they're white, only usually they have hands. There was no real time or otherwise at the arcade, and we could sit for hours with a handful of stragglers, spinning words, or be content within commiserating silence. Fred would have a few beers and I would drink black coffee. One such morning at the arcade bar, as he gazed at the great wall clock, Fred suddenly got an idea for a TV show. Fred's segment, Drunk in the Afternoon, fell in the realm of the clock with no hands, unfettered by time and social expectations. It would feature one guest who would join him at the table beneath the clock, just drinking and talking. They could go as far as their mutual intoxication would take them. Fred could communicate well on any subject, from Tom Watson's golf swing to the Chicago riots to the decline of the railroad. Fred made a list of possible guests from all walks of life. On the top of his list was Cliff Robertson, a somewhat troubled B actor who shared Fred's enthusiasm for aviation, a man close to his heart. Depending on how it was going, at at any old time, I would have a 15-minute segment called Coffee Break. The idea was that we were going to get Nescafe to sponsor my segment. I would not have guests, but would invite viewers to have a cup of Nescafe with me. On the other hand, Fred and his guests would not be obligated to communicate with the viewer, only with each other. I went as far as to find and purchase the perfect uniform for my segment, a gray and white pinstripe linen dress that buttoned down the front with cap sleeves and two pockets, French penitentiary style. Fred decided he would wear his khaki shirt with a dark brown tie. On coffee break, I planned to discuss prison literature, highlighting writers like Jean Genet and Albertine Sarrazin. On Drunk in the Afternoon, Fred might offer his guests some extremely fine cognac from a brown paper bag. Not all dreams are meant to be realized. That was what Fred used to say. We accomplished things that no one would ever know. In 1981, unexpectedly, he decided to learn to fly. We drove to the Outer Banks of North Carolina to salute America's first airfield at the Wright Brothers Memorial, taking U.S. Highway 158 to Kill Devil Hills. We then made our way along the southern coastline, moving from flight school to flight school. We journeyed through the Carolinas to Jacksonville, Florida, and on to Fernandina Beach, American Beach, Daytona Beach. Then we circled back to St. Augustine. There we stayed in a motel by the sea with a small kitchenette. Fred flew and drank Coca-Cola. I wrote and drank coffee. Fred finally achieved his pilot's license, but couldn't afford to fly a plane. I wrote incessantly, but published nothing. Through it all, we held fast to the concept of the clock with no hands. Tasks were completed, sump pumps manned, sandbags piled, trees planted, shirts ironed, hem-stitched, and yet we reserved the right to ignore the hands that kept turning. Looking back, long after his death, our way of living seems a miracle, one that could only be achieved by the silent synchronization of the jewels and gears of a common mind.
Given your soul to keep all of the power that
turns into flame, ignites, excites in a single name. Frederick, name of care, fast asleep in a room somewhere. Guardian angel, lay a bed, shed a light on my sleepy head. High on a threshold, yearning to sing, down with the dancers, having one last fling. Here's to the moment when we said hello. Cuddle my spirit, are you ready? Let's go. Astonished to death, night of wonder, promise to keep. Spread our sails, channel the deep, capture the rapture, two hearts beat, combine, entwine in a single beat. Frederick, you're the one, as we journey from sun to sun, all the things I've waited so long for, fly tonight, so long, so long. I, hey, hey, maybe we will come back someday now, but tonight on the wings of a dove. Tonight, many of these songs or thoughts encompass two very important men in my life. Robert Mapplethorpe, who was the artist of my life, and Fred, who was the love of my life. And they finally met in 86 when Robert became ill. He was in the hospital with complications from AIDS, and Fred drove us from Detroit to New York to see him. And they got to know each other. And then when we were going to do the record Dream of Life, Fred wanted Robert to take the photograph on the cover. We were all in Los Angeles. Robert was visiting his youngest brother, Edward, and he decided to shoot the cover there, while Fred and I worked to complete the album with our co-producer, Jimmy Iovine. Robert was pale and his hand shook as he set up to take the portrait before a cluster of drying palms in the full sun. When he dropped his light meter, Edward knelt to pick it up. Robert was not feeling well, but somehow he marshaled his energies and took the picture. Within that moment was trust, compassion, and our mutual sense of irony. He was carrying death within him, and I was carrying life. We were both aware of that, I know. It was a simple photograph. My hair is braided like Frida Kahlo's, the sun is in my eyes, and I am looking at Robert, and he is alive. Later that evening, Robert attended the recording of the lullaby that Fred and I had written for our son Jackson. There was a nod to Robert in the second verse. Little blue star that offers light. Blue star being one of my nicknames for him. Robert sat on the couch in the control room. I would always remember the date. It was the 19th of March, the birthday of my mother. Richard Soul was at the piano. I was facing him. We were recording live. The baby moved within me. Richard asked Fred if he had any special orders. "Make them cry, Richard," was all he said. We had one false start, and then we put everything we had into the second take. As I finished, Richard repeated the final chords. I looked through the glass window into the control room. Robert had fallen asleep on the couch, and Fred was standing alone, weeping.
Someday
you go. And in the sky, if you should see warrior wings, remember Daddy. And if a mama bird you see folding her wings, will you remember me as you go? Look at the big lug now. You know, it's really funny. Robert always wanted me to have a hit record. And we recorded Horses, and Robert was listening to it, and he goes, it's really good. Patty, where's the hit? You know? Robert loved Motown, and there's nothing to dance to. You know, I'm just not, it's not, it's my, not my beat. I don't know how to write a hit. So we used to argue about this all the time. I did another record called Radio Ethiopia. Patty, this is, and he said, Patty, this is worse than the other one. There's like, finally, after a couple of tries, he got his wish. I finally did have somewhat of a hit record, and the song was for Fred. A nice little way to bring them both together. One late afternoon in 1978, Robert and I were walking down 8th Street when we heard Because the Night blasting from one storefront after another. It was my collaboration with Bruce Springsteen, the single from the album Easter. Robert was our first listener after we had recorded the song. I had a reason for that. It was what he always wanted for me. In the summer of 1978, it rose to number 13 on the top 40 chart, fulfilling Robert's dream that I would one day have a hit record. Robert was smiling and walking in rhythm with the song. He took out a cigarette and lit it. We had been through a lot since he first rescued me from the science fiction writer and shared an egg cream on a stoop near Tompkins Square. Well, I can't tell you the science fiction writer story now because it's too long and intense, but I will tell you this guy was scary. He wore a black turtleneck and a medallion. Robert was unabashedly proud of my success. What he wanted for himself, he wanted for us both. He exhaled a perfect stream of smoke and spoke in a tone he only used with me, a bemused scolding, admiration without envy, our brother-sister language. Patty, he drawled, you got famous before me. Baby, here as I am, pull me close. always trying, understand. Desire is hunger, is the fire I breathe. Love is a banquet on which we feed. Come on now, try and understand the way I feel under your command. Take me now as the sun descends. They can't hurt you now, can't hurt you now, can't hurt you now. Wow, 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 wow. Because the night belongs to lovers. Because the night belongs to love. Because the night belongs to lovers. Because the night belongs to us. Have I dealt when I'm alone? Love is a ring, the telephone. Love is an angel disguised as lust, here in our bed until the morning comes. But come on now, try and understand the way I feel under your command. Take my hand as the sun descends. They can't hurt you now, can't hurt you now. I dreamed I was somewhere that was also nowhere. It looked like a thoroughfare in Raleigh, North Carolina, with small highways crossing each other. No one was around, and then I saw Fred running, though he seldom ran.